Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 172 on how to avoid capital gains tax using a deferred sales trust or like-kind exchange with Carl Warden. If you're into real estate investing and building wealth, congratulations, you are in the right place. My goal as your host of the REI Diamond Show is to invite guests who specialize in building wealth, such as real estate investors and industry service providers, and to draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods they've used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. On this episode, Carl and I discuss in depth the deferred sales trust as a tax deferral strategy, not only for real estate investors exchanging real estate, but for any highly appreciated asset. And of course, we also touch on the 1031 exchange, as well as the lesser known conservation easement, which is recently popular in the headlines as a tool implemented by Donald Trump to avoid being overtaxed. Our guest, Carl, is a tax deferral consultant and registered financial advisor who has assembled the perfect team of tax deferral tools and a team of professionals to help high net worth investors legally avoid being overtaxed. Enjoy. All right, Carl Warden, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you for having me.
Nice. So I appreciate you coming on, first of all. It's always a hot topic among real estate investors, I'm sure real estate agents. I'm sure everybody in the country hates paying taxes, but I know for sure that the real estate community has an aversion to it and does a lot of their business structuring, deals, et cetera, for that. So I'm sure our topic's going to be like a hot topic for the listeners, for our audience too. But why don't you give a little bit of background, kind of what you do and what led up to doing what you do and why that would be important to like real estate investors who might be listening right now?
Sure. Yeah. So, I've been in the financial services industry for quite some time. I actually got my insurance license in 1989 to give you an idea. So I've been around for a while. I've been a real estate investor for almost 30 years. I actually started by reading a book called Nothing Down for the 90s. Excellent book. Got me started in my career there. And what ended up happening was, as a young kid, believe it or not, I'm kind of a weirdo when it comes to real estate. I used to actually look in the newspaper at 11 years old at houses for sale. So real estate is kind of in my blood. Yeah, did you?
Oh, yeah.
So, one of the other things I was always interested in from a young man to today is, how do the rich avoid paying taxes? How is it that they do end up keeping all of their money? And so that's always intrigued me. I never thought about pursuing it as a career, actually. What ended up happening was I worked with a financial services firm, and it was a buy term and invest the difference firm. You might know who I'm talking about. And I did that for about 9 years. And the concept was that you would sit down with families and you would review their financial situations. You'd look for ways to show them how to do things better. And I felt at about 30 years old when I got involved with that company that I was a good, mentor, or could be a good mentor, because by the time I was 30, I owned 3 houses. Nobody gave me money. I worked my butt off for it. I started saving $25 a week. And so I felt like I was a good, mentor. I mean, if you're going to go to the gym, you don't want the 300-pound trainer, right? You want the fit trainer, the one you want to look like. So I felt like I'd be a good mentor. So I started this process of helping people with their financial situation. And it actually became rather discouraging because, we were helping people, middle-income America, save money. We were trying to find ways to help them save money. And what we found is that most of them, even though we had great ideas, they weren't taking the money savings and actually saving it. But many of the homes that we sat in were actually owned by the people that we were sitting with. And so I ended up resigning from this company about 2007. I got my Series 7 license and became more of a full-blown financial advisor, IAR, investment advisory representative. Didn't work with a couple of broker dealers. And then in 2009, I was made aware of a strategy called the Deferred Sales Trust. And many real estate investors are probably all too aware of the 1031 exchange, which is primarily applicable to investment property. This particular strategy was applicable to any kind of property, primary residence, second home, investment property, business assets. And I got to tell you, Dan, when I found out about this strategy, it was like my head exploded. I'm like, oh my God, this is what the baby boomer generation needs. Because that's who I was sitting down with for the most part. And, you know, later on in life, you know, more recently, I have added a plethora of other strategies and really decided to kind of recharacterize myself as a tax deferral consultant. And to be clear, I'm not a CPA. I'm not a tax attorney. I'm not a trust attorney. However, I have been able to amass some of the best tax attorneys, trust attorneys, CPAs as part of our team. And so essentially what we do is we show people how they can sell these assets and keep most, if not all, of the money working for them. So to answer part of your question is, you know, what would be the possible benefit or what would be the interest for real estate agents? I would have to say this. I'd have to say that if you're going to be in the real estate industry, you should probably know your client. And so, Dan, I have a couple questions for you to see if you kind of know the answer to these. But you can Google this information. I'd strongly encourage you to do it. Okay. Baby boomer generation, born 1946 to 1964. 10,000 people per day on average were born during that period of time. Okay. We've heard that ad nauseum, right? But do you know much about them financially? So I have a question for you. If you were to look out your window right now and look at every single asset that you see, every house, every business, every investment property, okay, what percentage, or every stock for that matter, what percentage of every asset that you see and that you know about is owned by that generation? You have an idea?
I don't. Probably 50, 60%, maybe more.
Very, very good. Yeah, it's actually in the neighborhood of 50 to 55%. I see varying numbers on that, but it's about 50 to 55%. Now, of everything you see out your window in the United States of America is owned by that generation. Okay. Now, the United States, if you were to put a big for sale sign right in the middle of it, okay, how much do you think we could sell it? Lock, stock, and barrel, how much do you think we could sell it for? How much is it worth? Let me put it that way. You have an idea?
Geez, I don't even know on that one.
Somewhere between 150 and 170, 150 and 160 trillion with a T. Okay. So again, let's go back to the baby boomers. They own 50 to 55% of 150 to 160 trillion dollars worth of assets in this country. Okay. Now let me give you the other stat. 80% of everything they own, their net worth, is in real estate. It's not in IRAs, 401ks, and cash. It's in real estate, either their primary residence, second home, or investment property. Many of them bought assets smartly years ago. They have been indoctrinated because they've been working for 40 to 50 years of their lives, right? And they've gone through this self-indoctrination process of asset preservation. So much so that many of them had dreams when they're in their 20s of retiring at some point in their life and enjoying the fruits of their labor, and are willing to completely and totally forego those dreams because the last thing they want to do is sell any of those assets and give, you know, 20 to 50% of their money to Uncle Sam. 20 to 50% of everything they've worked for the last 40 years or 50 years. Okay. So in 2009, I find out about a strategy that enables them to be able to liquidate these assets and legally keep most, if not all, of the money working for them. My head exploded. I said, this is the way this generation is going to be able to retire. And since then, I've added additional strategies. We've got quite a few that we offer now. And effectively, what we do is we strategize using the various different options for showing people how they can legally sell their assets and keep most, if not all, of the money working for them. And that's it in a nutshell.
Cool. Cool. So let's talk about the deferred sales trust. How does it work? And can you provide an easy to understand example of like really what happened? I mean, you don't have to name clients' names, but just so anyone listening would kind of get the nuts and bolts example of it.
Yeah. So give you a little bit of additional information. So the where was I going with that? I mean, the nuts and bolts are fairly simple. When you think of the tax code, okay, and I find it ironic, by the way, that the tax code is called the tax code, right? Or perhaps coincidental is a better word, because it's like you need an enigma machine to decipher it, right?
Nice.
I mean, most people can't read that thing, right? And it's almost like it's by design, okay? The very wealthy people don't necessarily read it, but what they do is they find somebody like defertax.com and they have us help them decipher it and help them put things in place. And that's really what we do. But the strategy is pretty simple. And I want to be clear. We developed a website called defertax.com. And let me give you a little background on why I developed it. I've been teaching the subject since 2009. Okay. When I found out about this strategy, I immediately took this and the 1031 exchange. I called up a 1031 exchange accommodator and said, hey, you can defer tax on investment property. I can defer tax on any property. Why don't we figure out a way to work together? 3 days later, I became a representative of that 1031 exchange accommodator. And I've been representing them ever since, a company called Exchange Solutions out of San Jose. They're a fantastic company. But one of the things I discovered in my tenure as a teacher is that, you know, most people learn in one of three ways: reading, being taught in a classroom setting, or audiovisual. Okay. And just like I alluded to a minute ago, you know, if I handed you four or five sections of the tax code ban and said, here, this is what I'm doing, you'd probably glaze over. Okay. Maybe you might understand it better than most, right? But the bottom line is that people need a much more simplified explanation of these options. So what I've discovered is that if I can teach you this concept and then, you know, verbally, and then I have an audio visual that will actually kind of walk you through it again, like even in a cartoon format, that you would probably pick up about at least 80% of what I'm saying. Okay. So I would encourage you, if you're interested, definitely go to defertax.com and you can click the join button. It doesn't cost anything. You can either type in an access code of defertax, same name as the website, or you can just click the button that says, I don't have an access code. Either way, you can get in and you can watch the video on this particular strategy. So I'll give it a run through though. Okay. So essentially, the deferred sales trust uses two basic ideas. Number one, tax law, obviously, and number two, trust law. Now, trust law is an interesting thing because it actually predates tax law and takes precedence. A lot of people are largely unaware of that. From a trust law perspective, we use what's called a third-party irrevocable business trust. And essentially, this particular document or entity has the same capacity or same ability to act in a financial capacity exactly the same way as you and I do, Dan. So it can run a business. It has profits, losses, expenses. It files its own tax return because it has its own tax ID number. And it can also buy things on an installment sale basis and sell things on an installment sale basis. And that's kind of the segue into the tax law side of things. From a tax law perspective, It uses something called IRC 453. And if you don't know what that is, it's actually one of the oldest tax deferral strategies in the IRS tax code. The tax code dates back to 1913. This thing goes all the way back to 1917. And essentially what it gives you the ability to do, Dan, is sell your, let's just say, $2 million asset that you paid maybe $50,000 for, and you could legally sell it to me under terms, okay? The terms could be 5% interest only, no payments for 2 years, and nothing down, okay? If we both agree to that, arguably you probably wouldn't do that with one of your assets, but that's besides the point. but you could legally do that, and if I sign on the dotted line, those are the terms, and that's what I'm obligated to pay you. Now, here's the thing. I own your asset now, and I effectively have all of your cash, too, don't I?
You're hanging on to it.
Yeah, that's right. So the second part of the tax code that this deferred sales trust abides by is called the constructive receipt rule. And basically what it states is once you take either possession or control of income from a job, profits from a business, or capital gains from the sale of an asset like this, it's a taxable event. So one thing that the rich know that many listeners here don't know is that if you can find ways to still, you know, own the asset, right, but without taking possession or control of it, then you won't pay the tax. I've taught this, by the way, in CPA offices before, and I've not gotten really too much kickback. CPAs don't focus on tax deferral anyway, but that's besides the point. So what we've done here is we've created a situation where you, Dan, you sold me this $2 million asset, whatever the heck it is. You have a basis of $50,000. You made $1.95 million on the sale to me, okay? But you didn't pay any taxes because you're going to file your tax return in 21. You're going to file form, I believe it's 6252, indicating that you sold on an installment sale this $2 million asset to me, and you're going to indicate on there no money received, no payments, no down payment. And how much in taxes will you pay?
Not that year you won't.
That's right. That's right. So what the deferred sales trust does is it abides by that basic concept. We structure a trust in place of you as the seller of the property. What's going to happen, Dan, is you're going to actually sell the property to the trust for the $2,000. The trust with the trustee is going to purchase on a paper sale transaction that asset for $2 million. 2 minutes later, in a simultaneous transaction, that asset is sold to the end user. Okay? Whoever that is, they take the property, they take the asset, they're gone. They're out of the picture. The $2 million came to escrow. The escrow officer paid off sales charges, closing costs, commissions, et cetera, whatever, and shipped the remainder of the proceeds to the seller of the property, which in this case is the trust. You don't pay any taxes because you never took possession of the money yet. The trust doesn't pay any taxes because it purchased it for $2 million and sold it for $2 million, no profit. Okay? So the beauty of this, there's multiple benefits to this concept. Number one, tax deferral. You didn't take possession of the money, you won't pay the tax. Number two, you can invest the money much, you know, inside the trust, much the same as you could inside of an IRA or a 401k. Benefit number three, you can take distributions off this trust in whatever dollar amount or frequency you choose. Incidentally, when you do pick the investment portfolio, the overall returns of that portfolio dictate the note rate that is owed back to you. Okay? So if we run a risk profile questionnaire on you, Dan, and we come to the conclusion that a series of investments would, you're a conservative investor, would only achieve 6%, that becomes the note rate of the trust. Okay? Benefit number three, you can take the distributions from the trust, whatever dollar amount or frequency you choose. Benefit number four, it's inheritable intact. So your beneficiaries can inherit it. There's other benefits and stuff like that, but I'd rather table those for perhaps one-on-one conversations with anybody who's interested in finding out more. But there are multiple ways you can use this individually or in combination with other strategies. So that's the deferred sales trust in a nutshell. The 3-minute video is on defertax.com. You can watch that after listening to this, and it should pretty much lock it in for you. You'll get a pretty much about an 80% understanding of this thing. And then ultimately through further conversation, consultation, we can make a determination if it's right for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is very detailed and in depth, and you know, your stuff, the form numbers and the, it shows that you have a very strong depth of it. I think, you know, basically you're selling the highly appreciated asset, and you have this middleman trust that then becomes the trust. Is that your asset? Because the trust is not quite an entity, right? It's not like an LLC or a corporation, but it's something sort of in the middle.
It basically is an entity. Yes. You know, it's got its own tax ID number. And this trust actually purchases the asset from you. Yeah. So, again, it doesn't pay the taxes because it buys it for $2 million, sells it for $2 million in our example.
Do you happen to know if a trust could take someone to court? So let's say that the $2 million asset was, you know, somehow has some issue with another loan. Could that trust initiate a lawsuit against another person or entity?
You know, I got to be frank with you. I've never been asked that question.
Yeah, it's
a deep
one.
I can get the answer, but I've never been asked that question before. Yeah, you stumped the Carl. And some of my real estate agents like to play that game to see if they can stump me. Well, you got me.
Yeah, and I can't really think of a reason where, I mean, so the trust, if I think of the trust like a 401k, it makes sense, right? And that is a trust account, I believe, right, Carl? 401k, IRA, that's all trust accounts, right?
Custodian, I mean, it's a retirement account. It's a retirement account held by a custodian. I don't know that it's a trust account. I wouldn't necessarily call it that.
Okay. So it's like, because like on one hand, I could see that a trust where it was mostly cash or a bunch of stocks, I don't know that it would ever be in a position to initiate a lawsuit. But, you know, let's take the example of
trust. To be frank with you, I think you're spot on, Dan. I don't think there would be any reason whatsoever for this trust, you know, to take a, because the trust is the creditor, right? The trust is the one that owes the money. So why would it take a lien holder to court? There would be no reason for that.
Yeah, so the trust buys real estate, and then the trust is now in a dispute with the previous owner of the said real estate over the condition of the roof being misrepresented. That's why I was asking the question if there's this additional layer of kind of risk that was taken on by the trust and by using this strategy versus a little bit of a cleaner, higher pressure, more familiar 1031, where my new LLC would have the legal recourse to seek relief in the court. But the trust, I don't know that it would have that. I don't know, honestly, the answer, but it might be something I would be concerned about it if I was putting, you know, my big nest egg in that $2 million was, let's say, all the money I had in the world. I would kind of want to know, you know, are there any other layers of additional risk that I'm maybe not aware of? Or maybe there are some other risks that you would mention, not necessarily the taking to court case, but maybe are there any other risks that someone would probably want to be aware of with their eyes open going into this with their highly appreciated asset?
So I average about one or two of these a month, at least, at a minimum. And I will have to tell you that in every case where a buyer of an asset had an issue with a seller, they just dealt separately with the seller. They didn't deal with the trust that captured the proceeds. So you asked me a question I've never heard before, probably because it's never come up before, but that doesn't mean it's not valid. It's definitely very valid. And the beauty that I have is that I have tax attorneys on my team who can answer it. So I can certainly get you that answer, Dan.
Yeah, I know I went off on a big limb there.
That was a tangent. That was a tangent.
I had a trust. I've used trust for real estate in a bunch of different reasons before. And we had a situation where we were trying to enforce a contract that was written with our trust as the buyer.
and we ran into a wall where we were unable to pursue it in court. Now, I don't know if it was just that our attorneys or the judge kind of ruled against it, or if they weren't familiar with it and kind of dismissed us, or whether there were, you know, actual case law that precluded us from pursuing it. But all that aside, I've heard of a deferred sales trust, you know, in the past. It makes sense. Unfortunately, I'm not a great client because most of my assets are kind of these much smaller gains. But it kind of brings to light a question. What size gain, Carl, would be on the minimum side, right? $100 million gain, we all get it. We want to avoid having to pay $370 million. But, like, what would be the smaller gains, right? If I got a house I'm selling and it's a $40,000 gain, I mean, is it really worth going through all of the added paperwork layers and things of that nature? Or is it, like, maybe $500,000? Like, what size gain makes it worth the additional effort to put this together?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's relative to the client, right? I mean, the smallest one I did was $60,000. Now, that's not a lot of money, but it was a lot of money for this client. So they didn't want to pay the tax on the 60, so we ended up doing it. I will tell you that that was a one-off. I have not done, cases that small since. Most of the time, what you'll find is if the client's going to have to pay $100,000 or more in taxes, that becomes that's kind of the threshold. When you get into the scenario like what you're talking about is a $40,000 gain on something, I might be more inclined to say, hey, let's do something simple called the 1031 exchange. Or if you're not interested in repurchasing real estate that you would have to manage and, you know, I say deal with the 7 T's, which is the tenants, toilets, trash, taxes, termites, turnover, and teenagers, right?
Yeah.
Then not necessarily in that order, but you ultimately could go for something like even a Delaware statutory trust, depending upon your net worth. You could also go with an opportunity fund. That's an interesting tax deferral idea with some tremendous tax benefits and growth benefits. And then there's also the conservation easement would perhaps possibly be another option. So
what is that, the conservation easement? Can you describe that? I've heard the term. I don't know what exactly that entails.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I would have to say that the greatest example probably of that, you know, everybody's all up in arms about Trump not paying any taxes. Well, Trump's just simply smart. It's funny. I get this all the time. California, taught a lot in California. And in California, they're all about a lot of them are all about paying taxes, usually somebody else, but they're always all about people paying taxes, right? And somebody piped up during a class I was doing for the Silicon Valley Association of Realtors, about 75 people in there, and somebody, you know, inevitably pipes up, there's nothing wrong with paying taxes. And, you know, I responded to the question by simply saying this, you know what, there's absolutely nothing wrong with paying taxes. It's a sign of success. We should pay taxes because it covers the roads and the fire departments, police departments, stuff like that, whatever. That's great. And it's great to pay taxes unless there was a legal way to avoid paying taxes. Then it's pretty stupid. Okay. Cause a lot of people, you know, really don't understand the tax law. And the tax law is really designed for you to do several things: get married, have babies, run a business, buy real estate, period. Okay. And truthfully, it's transaction oriented. So the concept behind tax deferral is to continue transactions. Transactions in this country generate taxes. If somebody has a piece of real estate and they die owning it, there's a step up in basis given to their heirs and no taxes are paid. Worse yet, if somebody didn't find out about us, defertax.com, right? And they die owning it, they get the step up in basis. Now here's what happens when somebody finds defertax.com, finds us. We educate the client. We inform the client comes up with solutions. The client says, okay, I'm ready to list. I have an exit. The real estate agent gets paid, the broker gets paid, the appraiser gets paid, the lender gets paid, the staging company gets paid, I mean, I could go on and on. Furniture companies get paid. You see what I'm saying? So tax deferral, there's nothing wrong with it. It just has to be done correctly and appropriately. Okay. So getting back to your question, that was a tangent. Sorry. So getting back to your question, conservation easement, one of the biggest examples, or perhaps better examples, is Trump. I didn't pay hardly any taxes. Well, I'll give you one of the reasons why. Conservation easement. Okay. As we all know, Trump has golf courses and he's got land around his golf courses. Okay. And so what he did was he took advantage of the conservation easement concept. I believe it's IRC 170H. You can look it up if you need to. Long story short, Trump designed, developmental plans for the land around his golf courses. And he actually did mock-up drawings, actual architectural drawings, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars putting all this together as though he was going to develop the land around his golf courses. Okay. Now the land around his golf courses was worth about $125 million. Okay. Instead, what he does is he gets an appraisal on what if he did this development around these golf courses. Several appraisals. Typically you do three and you pick the middle one. Now I don't know if he did three, but conservation easement companies typically do three and they'll do the middle one. Some of them will pick the lower one. But long story short, the appraisal came in at $500 million. Okay? So $125 million piece of land. He says, you know what? There's a yellow-belly, red-spotted lizard or something like that there. I'm going to donate this thing to a conservation easement. It qualifies. President Trump gets a $500 million write-off. Okay? So essentially, he donated $125 million to get $500 million write off. Okay? Now, how can, we as, little investors get in on that? Well, this is an accredited investor product. Okay? You can't do it unless you're an accredited investor, million of net worth exclusive of your primary residence. Okay? But the bottom line is, you could actually, there are companies, and only really, there's frankly only two that I would even work with. But there are companies that actually, what they'll do is they'll buy either a piece of land or they'll buy a building, a historical building, and they'll do the exact same thing. They'll run plans, and some of them are even, oil. There's oil or there's mineral rights underneath the land. And in the process of structuring these deals, they buy the land, they run the plans. They determine that, let's just say it's they buy it for $10 million. They determine that the future value after improvements is $50 million. Instead, they go with a conservation easement and they put it into a fund. Okay, so what that does is that allows investors like you and me to come in with like $100,000, for example, and buy a piece of that $10 million portion. But in the process of buying the $100,000, donating this $100,000 to this land purchase, I'm getting a $500,000 write off because it's a 5-to-1 write off if you follow the math. Okay, so
yep.
The advantage of that is if you're a high income earner, where you make, let's say you make $1 million a year, right? Even 500,000 a year will work, but I like $1 million. Let's just use that. You make $1 million a year. And of course, Uncle Sam wants half of it, hypothetically, right? Well, mm-hmm. One option you have is to just donate half of it, right? I'm going to donate half of it. Well, guess what? You still get $500,000 left. You're still going to have to pay taxes on the 500,000. You might have lowered your tax bill, but probably not. Let's just say your tax bill on that is 50% still. Hypothetically. Well, that means you're going to pay $250,000 in tax. Obviously, it's not going to be that high, but let's just say it is. Okay. Now, if you did a conservation easement investment instead of just giving a donation, right? And by the way, I didn't finish my numbers there. You donate $500,000, gone. $500,000's gone. Then you stop to pay taxes on the $500,000. You're left with $250,000. You with me?
Yeah.
Make sense? Okay, good. Now, conservation easement option. I'm going to donate $100,000 to a conservation easement. I'm going to get the $500,000 write-off. Okay. I still have to pay taxes on the remainder $500,000. It's still $250,000. My total outlay is $350,000. Right. And I'm left with $650,000. Right. In my pocket. So at the end of the day, if I made $1 million, I have a choice. I can be left with, you know, paying the taxes and having $500,000 left. I can donate half of it and have $250,000 left, or I can take advantage of a conservation easement and have $650,000 left. I don't think if I threw those three numbers together on a white sheet of paper, you'd have an argument as to which one you'd want, right?
Yeah. Now, so essentially, you're paying that tax money out anyway. So instead of just paying it directly to the IRS that year, you invested into the conservation easement project, I guess you would call it, except you probably have to put, you know, 50, 60, 70 cents on the dollar of the actual tax bill into the conservation easement to get the write-off back to kind of cover the taxes. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Certainly a good option for high-income earners. And by the way, selling a highly appreciated asset like real estate or stock or something like that can automatically throw you into the higher income tax brackets. So the companies that I work with, we have a computer program where we kind of plug in your state, you know, your tax rates, and plug in the dollar amounts, plug in your income, plug in, you know, what if we invested in this opportunity, or sorry, conservation even. You know, what would be your overall tax savings? And it really kind of is a no-brainer.
Yeah, and back to, you know, one of the little additional things that you mentioned that jumped to mind here. You had talked about, you know, the real estate agent raising their hand and saying, well, paying taxes is good. And yeah, but you know what else is good is money that remains invested in assets. So if you think of the different type of asset levels that exist in our country, we have cash, right? And that's usually the most obvious and early introduction that we have to money in our life. And then we have things like credit, you know, credit cards and getting notes and mortgages and things of that nature. And that's like this next level of cash. I mean, if you know about the secondary real estate mortgage market, debt market, I mean, that stuff is traded around the same way that stocks and bonds are traded around on Wall Street, TD, Ameritrade, Fidelity, et cetera. And stocks and bonds would be like another level of money. And real estate is just like less liquid, but still important. In fact, one of the foundations of why our country is here and why it was so exciting is the private property rights that we have here in America and have enjoyed for so long. And the tax code is set up to kind of benefit the value in any one of these different assets. And like the example that pops to mind for me that's very recent for everybody, if you had money in the market on February 1st and then looked at the money you had in the market on April 4th, 5th, or 10th, right, you see what happens when everybody decides to convert those assets to cash. And so the tax code is structured with the, you know, allowance of the deferred sales trust, the things that maybe the conservation easements and maybe the 1031 exchanges and things of this nature. They're there to help incentivize, you know, everyone, the economy at large, to keep a lot, if not all of or much of the money invested over the long term, because it's good for the overall country. It's good for the world for that money to remain not in cash
100%.
Form, right?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, a great example of that is the recapture tax. Like, look, we're gonna give you a benefit for investing in real estate. We're gonna allow you to depreciate the structure value of the real estate and apply that annual depreciation amount against any incomes, therefore reducing your overall tax liability on the income that's coming in substantially. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be your incentive for investing. One of them. Okay. But hey, if you want to sell, we want our 25%. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the state, right? Whatever state you're in, right? If you got state tax. So yeah, no, they don't want you to sell and cash out. What they want you to do is they want you to sell and reinvest into a bigger, better property. That's really the tax code is really written to incentivize you to do that. So, frankly, you know, to your point, I mean, I think we all know real estate is probably one of the greatest wealth building tools there is. I mean, you know, I'm a registered investment advisor, and I have conversations with clients all the time. And I had this young lady who sat with me. I've known her parents have been clients of mine for a while. And she's a young girl, 29 years old, she's got $140,000 saved up. And she's having a conversation with me, and she says, Carl, I'm thinking about investing this money. It's sitting in my bank account. She's a hairdresser. And
nice.
Sitting in your bank account. I said, okay. I said, what are you thinking? She said, well, I my mom's been investing with you for a while. She's happy with you. I kind of want some ideas there. And she said, well, the other idea is I actually thought about maybe buying some real estate. And I said, really? And I said, tell me about that. So she does. And I said, well, listen, one of the greatest lessons I ever learned was the concept of leverage. Okay. And you already know where I'm going with this. If you take $100,000 and you invest it with me as an investment advisor, if I'm doing a really good job, I'm averaging you about 10% per year. That's if I'm doing a really good job. Let's be real. Okay. However, if you take that same $100,000 and put it as a 20% down payment on a $500,000 investment property, okay, and that investment property only goes up in appreciation by 4%, okay, that's a $20,000 gain on the $500,000. So your $100,000 grew by $20,000 or 20%. I said, I can't beat that. I said, there might be some years where I could, but there's no better investment option than that. So my suggestion is that, you know, be smart and look for real estate opportunities. And so I had discussions with her about that and how I got started and what to look for, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the bottom line is that is the way to go. And it was the right decision and the right information for her. Right. So, by the way, just as an aside, you know, one of the things that we do when we do talk with clients, we are fiduciaries. Okay. From a tax deferral perspective, the very first thing that we do, we actually look for a reason why the client doesn't need us, which is really counterintuitive. But what it's allowed us to be able to do is establish upfront some form of credibility and trust in an industry where there's no credibility and trust or very little. Okay. So if we come across clients with large capital gain, for example, the very first thing we do is, you know, we ask them several questions. We actually give them a questionnaire to take to their CPA. And the questionnaire is really designed to trigger the CPA to look into things they might otherwise not have looked at. And the concept is we want to try to find ways where we can lower your tax bill enough that you can move forward with your transaction. So now this kind of dovetails into why should real estate professionals consider us as an ally? And frankly, what we try to do is we try to go in partnership with real estate agents, because real estate agents can't give tax advice, right? So they send them to the CPA, who doesn't know anything about tax deferral options, and hope that the CPA then turns around and gives the client back. That's not going to work. The CPA doesn't work for the real estate agent. The CPA works for the client. So we, on the other hand, we work for the client. So our objective is to educate the client, inform the client, and hopefully educate the client that they don't even have a tax bill, which enables the real estate agent to get the listing and help the client move forward and on with their lives. So that's a little bit of additional input on what we do and how we do it.
Nice. And as we get kind of to our wrap up here in a moment, would you mind just touching on your fee structure? Like, how do you get paid when a client reaches out? Just to kind of give people the background on what the business looks like as they approach you.
Yeah. So, one of the more well-known symbols in the world of financial services is the traveler's umbrella. And the concept is you have somebody holding the umbrella, and above them is all of these products and services. Okay. That's the way you would look at me. I have tax attorneys, trust attorneys, CPAs as part of my team. I have companies that provide Delaware statutory trust, deferred sales trust, conservation easement, cost segregation study, you know, opportunity funds. All right. And among others. Okay. I do get paid from these individuals, from these other companies, For example, if you did an opportunity fund with me, I'd get paid. As an RIA, there's a way for me to get paid. Same thing with conservation easement. If you did a product, if you did that product, I get paid. The deferred sales trust is a assets under management opportunity for me. So if I show the client how they can avoid paying taxes on that $2 million and we capture the $2 million in the trust instead of having them captured and pay an enormous amount in taxes, then I manage the $2 million inside the trust. So I get paid like any other financial advisor. As an investment advisor, I'm a fee-based financial advisor, so I don't take commission. I get paid fees. So anything under $1 million, I'm going to get paid like most other financial advisors where I get paid 1% of assets under management. We start getting over $1 million, 75 basis points. I think you get the idea. We have break points above that as well. But that's essentially how we get paid. I have a 1031 exchange accommodator that pays me, you know, for, you know, bringing them deals. And I'd like to point out, too, that I don't have an axe to grind. I don't favor any one of these particular strategies. My objective is to listen to the client, listen to their needs, and then ultimately make an assessment of which one is best for them. And frankly, if it's a $700 1031 exchange done with the company I represent, then that's exactly what should be in place for the client. So we put the client first and always, and that's how we work.
Yeah, I really appreciate you going into the granular detail of the variety of places that you might get paid. I think that transparency goes a long way when people understand, okay, yeah, there's commission for this, commission for that, but you offer this big variety of services, not necessarily in a menu fashion, but a what's best for the exact situation fashion. And I have seen, honestly, you know, as people who are the 1031 exchange company, it's the 1031 is the solution for everything. And if you're just doing the deferred sales trust, that's the solution for everything, right? So it's kind of refreshing.
You nailed it, Dan. And that is the big differentiator with us is we're not a one-trick pony. So we're not trying to shove a 1031 down your throat or a deferred sales trust or a Delaware statutory trust down your throat. Rather, we are tax deferral consultants. So we educate, we inform, we allow the client to make a decision as to which option would be best for them, and then we address products.
Nice. So, Carl, is there a book or two that you would recommend to our real estate investor audience?
The Tax Code. Well, that's where I've gotten a lot of my information. But I don't really have a whole lot of books. I learned a lot of what I know from opportunity fund providers, Delaware statutory trust providers. I mean, just Googling information. I've made it a study of mine to learn all of these different strategies and to be able to disseminate that information in a very simple fashion to clients. I told you earlier, I read a book, Nothing Down for the 90s. I would say if there's any new investors that are listening to your show, that is a must-read book. You won't necessarily be able to buy one for nothing down. I'm not saying you can't. This guy is phenomenal at doing it, and he can prove to you that he's done it. But what you get out of that book more than anything is a way to learn how to strategize transactions. And frankly, that book is probably a big reason why I'm able to take a look at tax deferral options and strategize where we're able to use one or more for any given application. So it was one that really helped me and it's still helping me. So there you go.
So if you could go back with your younger self, I don't know, 25, 30 years old, and share the crown jewel of wisdom, what would that be?
Honestly, the leverage lesson that I gave you, that by far, if you can understand that, then you can become wealthy. I'll give you another one. Find a way to work 100 hours a day, okay? You're never going to get financially independent and wealthy working for somebody else. Because why? Because they're trying to get rich. They're not trying to get you rich. So they're going to pay you as little as they have to, okay? Your job is to find a way to work 100 hours a day. How do you do that? Well, there's several different ways. One is you invest money in the stock market, where you're investing money in businesses, where you have people working to increase the value of those businesses. That's one way. You're getting a very small piece of each worker, tiny, in fact, but you're at least, you know, growing your net worth based on the efforts of others. Another way, buy real estate. You know, you have your home, you're going to work every day, you're bringing home a payment, right? And you're making that payment. How nice would it be to have one rental where you have two people in the house, you know, going to work every single day to give you part of their money? Okay. If you had 10 homes, right? That's quite a few people, working for you on a daily basis to give you money every day. Okay. When you can find a way to work 100 hours in a day where, you know, the 8 hours per person, you find 12 people that are willing to work for you somehow, either they're, renting your house or they're working in your business. That's how you can become financially independent in this country. Hard to do it on your own. You're not leveraging your time. That's what you need to do it in this country to make it wealthy.
I like it. An interesting take on leverage there. So how can listeners get more information about you or on how to defer tax, Carl?
Well, I've got the website, DeferTax, DeferTax.com. I also, I'd love for you to be a member on there. It doesn't cost you anything. The videos might seem silly, but the reality of it is they'll teach you at a basic level how these different things work. And then CarlWarden.com. I have that site also up and running. That's W-O-R-D-E-N. And Carl is with a C, C-A-R-L. Sometimes Starbucks spells it Carol. I think we all get our names messed up at Starbucks. But anyway, that would be the two sites you can find me on. And then you can also call us at 877-TAX-STRATEGY.
All right. Well, hey, I had a blast. I got pages of notes here, a ton of great ideas. Thank you for coming on the show, Carl.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Dan. Thank you very much for having me. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these two facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital, or starved from a lack thereof. And two, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at fundrehabdeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1 minute sign up process right now so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. Thanks again for tuning in. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. You can also access the full archive of wealth-building real estate investment jewels of wisdom at reidiamonds.com. My business, Diamond Equity, is that of buying, renovating, and selling houses. 223 in 2019 and 247 houses bought and sold so far in 2020. We currently have another 133 houses in inventory, either under construction, for sale, or sold awaiting closing. Here's how you and I can do business. Number one, we operate in Atlanta, Chicago, and the Philadelphia region. Before we begin construction on our housing inventory, we offer our houses for sale at wholesale pricing at dealswithroi.com. At that site, you can also review our current career postings, jobs we may have available, or sign up for the local buyers list.
That site, again, is dealswithroi.com. Number two, if you're an accredited investor and you enjoy earning double-digit returns passively on your capital and might consider funding a deal of mine, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunity emails. Number three, if you have a deal for sale in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have economist Paul Sloat joining us on the show with the 2021 U.S. economic forecast. Until then.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.